This tape contains an interview describing early childhood in a typical mining village and eventually the gravitation of boys into the mining industry as it was in the early 1930s. It continues to describe the development of mining through to the 1970s. The interview was conducted for the Industrial Museum at Dunarskin, near Dunwellington. The recording was made in 1994. I was born in 1920, one of a family of seven, living then in a typical room and kitchen of the period. Was indeed lucky to have loving and respected parents, but lying in my built-in hole-in-the-wall bed in the mornings, my earliest recollections were of tramping feet. We take it from there. Very few could afford even a bicycle. Nearly everyone tramped to work at one or other of the five working pits up the parish. That was a bank of 1 foot. Somehow, in our childhood, this sound was reassuring, comfortingly familiar, and seemed to convey that all was well. Only much later in life did we, the village boys, find out there was very little reassuring or comforting about life and work in the pits. This was, however, as yet, in the distant future.
So can you tell me what kind of games and things you did in your spare time when you were wee?
Life was a wee bit different in these days, but families were large then. From 5 to 10 children in most families was about the average. Naturally, the boys grouped together for play, as did the lasses. No wirelesses then. Only the occasional house in the village possessed a wind-up gramophone and a few scratchy records for it. If we had behaved kind of well, kept our nose clean, as the saying was, we were allowed to sit at night and listen to the gramophone being played. And my fair enjoyed it. This was something of a novelty. So far as outside games were concerned, they were all handmade, distinctly energetic and vigorous. Most of us ran mild wear, gears and cleats when we went messages. We also became experts with our whips and peeries. Yunks, or bulls, were constantly being played in the autumn, and pockets were usually worn into holes with a number of bulls and other pocket rubbish that we carried for swaps with our pals. We played numerous games. Run, sheep, run, chap the door, hunting, and many others, too numerous to mention. Imagination was fertile, and we were never at a loss to make up a game. We made and flew our own large kites. We called them dragons, or dragons. Much skill was shown in making these. Made from an ordinary garden cane, brown paper and string, all held together by wallpaper paste. Again, this was an autumn sport when winds were strong and gusty. Another variation was our local jiner used to make us a pair of stilts for roughly 2 or 3 pence. And we walked around in these stilts about a couple of feet above ground.
And we used to play at dunching each other off the stilts. And the person that could stay on longest was reckoned to be the best. We looked forward to and celebrated Halloween quite an occasion. When we blacked our face, stole a turnip out of the field, carved a face in it, and we took guys in. We had to do a wee piece, and were invariably rewarded with an apple and a handful of monkey nuts. Our big time was Christmas and New Year, or near day, as we call it. Christmas in the family was always a busy, busy time for our mothers. There were black buns to be baked, there were white buns to be baked, shortbread, all the goodies that were associated with Christmas and New Year. In these days, there were no facilities for baking these things at home. Well, what happened was, for lack of ovens, the buns and the shortbread were baked and made up in tins. And these tins were carried to the local bakehouse, where they were left for overnight firing and collected the following day. Oh, the lovely aroma in that bakehouse when you went to collect your mother's buns and shortbread. And of course we could hardly wait to get home to get a wee bit off the bun to see it had fired all right. Christmas, we didn't have elaborate gifts. There just wasn't the money around in these days for large gifts. But even in the early days, it was always a thrill on Christmas morning to wake up, generally as your dad was going to work, and to be handed in your stocking and finding it wonder of wonders. A half crown McKenna said, a cake of green face chocolate, an orange, an apple, maybe even a sixpence in the tray. And if you were awful lucky, you might even get a selection box with different sweeties in it. Oh, it was a great time. It didn't take an awful lot to please us. But because we didn't get so much during the year, Christmas seemed the greatest time of our lives. Very few houses that didn't manage to get away in something for Christmas, even where things were extremely tight. Parents made a big effort on behalf of their kids. Another favourite winter pastime around Christmas and New Year was the making of big slides out in the pads and in the roads. And I recall close to Nick, we used to pour water down the pad or the road. And I could hardly wait till it froze. And then the sliding started. We'd slide down, run back up the brae, slide down again, and this was going for hours at a time. Never felt the cold. It was searing the boots mine, and one of a clip in the air would go if some of our adults fell on the slide. And invariably then somebody would come out with a hand for a sort and put it in the slide. So we did have a lot of fun, but no costly fun. We were ingenious in making up games and keeping ourselves amused. Boredom? We didn't know what it meant. For most of us, Friday night was also a highlight. In normal times when work was steady, most of us were given our Friday penny and immediately dashed off to the sweetie shop. What wonders a penny could buy? A halfpenny lucky bag. You could even find a halfpenny inside it if you were lucky. So you get your halfpenny back, plus some sweeties and various other things like balloons and wee puzzles and tricks. Offer a halfpenny. For your remaining halfpenny, you could buy gobstoppers, aniseed balls, or some other delight such as a lucky taffy, which was a toffee potato with a prize inside. Sometimes it was a wee charm. Again, if you were lucky, you could get your halfpenny back wrapped in tissue paper inside the taffy. The lasses had just as many games as had the boys, their favourites being skipping ropes, hopscotch, beds chalked out in the ground and playing peavers. And they always had songs with their games. They sung all the time were playing. The Clive? No, I don't think so. At least, not many of us. Most parents were caring and took their family responsibilities very serious. In many cases, they denied themselves to ensure that their offspring were well clothed and well fed. The man was invariably the breadwinner. In these days, our mothers all stayed at home and looked after the families. If we had a calamity or an upset, our mother was aye there to comfort us. So again, it was rather different then to what it is now.
So what kind of things do you remember about the school when you come up?
Well, I don't quite know when conscious recollection starts, but I do remember being in the infant class at school under a teacher by the name of Miss Boyle, and she was awful good to us. To get us out of sprite at being away from our mums, she used to make up wee games that we could play and this sort of thing. So I vaguely remember that kind of thing. But conscious thought and conscious memory only began some years later. I do remember the 11 plus in these days, when all our efforts at school up to that point were tested. And on the results of that 11 plus exam, it was decided whether you could be admitted to the higher grade or simply to the advanced division. The higher grade was a further three-year course at school. The advanced division course was 2 years. In many cases, people had the ability to go to the higher grade, which included languages, but circumstances at home meant that very few took up the offer, because most families needed every penny they had to survive and to feed the families. It was therefore imperative that boys and lasses could be got to work at the earliest possible moment. And only a very few families were in a position to allow their children to go into higher grade and to carry on to academy, and even fewer still were in a position to allow them to carry on from the academy to a university. Most of us had no choice but to leave school at 14 and look for employment. So far as employment was concerned, the choices were stark. We had been at school from 5 years until 14, so we had 9 years schooling. At times, it seemed that the school year would never end. But looking back on them after we had left school, they were the shortest years of our life. At 14, we left and we were invariably in employment within a week or two of leaving school. Jobs were not well paid, but they were plentiful, provided you were prepared to be a miner or a farm servant. The choice actually was stark: the pits or the farms. No light indecision in the area then, and in either case, the hours were long, the work was hard, and the pay was pitiful. A boy starting at pit head work was usually paid about 2 and threepence a day for an 8-hour day. His first job was usually known as craw picking. I'm sure most people know what that was, but basically it was standing alongside a conveyor belt in the screening plant and picking out rock and stones from the coal as it travelled along the belt. 6 days of this turned a boy about 13 and 6 for a 44-hour week. In today's money, that's about 6 to 7.5p. After a few weeks of this, most of the boys got a chance at a job doing the pit. Usually, a job in the shaft bottom, helping to push, pull, or handle hutches full of coal. This usually got one a rise of about threepence a day. Big deal. From the pit bottom, one eventually gravitated to a job on what they called the inside. That was on a working well away from the pit bottom. It entailed up to possibly a mile or a mile and a half of a walk from the pit bottom to one or other of the coal seams. Initially, when a boy went from the pit bottom, he was usually given a job driving a wee haulage engine, which was used to haul hutches out to the main haulage for transport to the pit bottom. After he'd become competent at this, he was usually offered a job in one or other of the coal faces. A lot of the places then were what were called narrow workings, where two men were employed to excavate the coal, or hout the coal as we talked about, in a place about 10 to 12 feet wide and usually about 4 to 5 feet high. This was known as a collier and his drawer, the young man being the drawer. His job was to go out and collect an empty hutch from the lie where these hutches were standing, to take it into his neighbour at the coal face, to fill it with coal, which the neighbour was busy digging, and then to push the loaded hutch back out to the lie and collect a further empty. From there, again, inevitably, we graduated as boys or as young men then to what they called long wall coal face working. This was a system which was then being introduced where a coal face was actually opened up between two roadways. The roadways were then roughly about a couple of hundred feet apart. They were driven parallel to each other, and they were linked at the inside end up through the coal seam, which exposed 200 feet of coal. This was then cut by a coal cutting machine. It was undercut at the level of the floor, and it was blasted down while the roof supports had been set previously, and miners were then employed to shovel the blasted coal into a form of shaker conveyor, which shoot the coal down to a loading point where it was filled into hutches. So that was the modern method up until about 1939-40, when the war started. Now, at this point in time, I lost touch with the coal industry, because in the days of the Battle of Britain, like most youngsters, I was fired with determination that the Germans weren't going to tramp all over us, and I couldn't wait to join up. So I got into the Air Force, and for the next 5 years I spent a year under training, and the remaining 4 years mainly in the Far East against the Japs. I never saw a German, I saw Japanese. So for these 5 years, I lost touch with the coal industry.
Okay, so after the war, when you came back to New Cumberland, how did you resume civilian life?
I came back, I found that the mining picture had changed completely. lease land had been extended by the American government to include mining equipment. And where before most coal in British mines was what we called hand-got, we now had a lot of very expensive and elaborate machines doing the same job. We had a device known as a joy loader, which had two claw-like arms, and these arms revolved and raked and clawed the coal onto the machine's duckbill snout, from where it went onto a small loader and was transferred into a device known as a shuttle car. The shuttle car was in fact a low loader with a capacity of about 3 to 4 tons. As the joy loader transferred its coal into the shuttle car, it gradually filled up, and as it was full, it drove away to the end of the belt, what was known as a loading end. The base of the joy loader was actually a conveyor belt. The driver would engage the conveyor belt and it would discharge its 3 to 4 tons of coal onto the loading end of the belt, from where it would go out to the loading point and be transferred into hutches, or at that time the start of mine cars, which were a larger version of hutches. So that was the type of thing. Explosives at that point had changed completely from the old business of strum and caps. We had gone to the other end of the scale. Instead of explosives now, in this mechanised section, we were actually blasting the coal with gas-filled cylinders. What happened was, we were given these cylinders, which looked like 4 or 5 feet long lengths of drain pipe, about 2 to 3 inches in diameter. The shot holes were larger than what was required for explosives, larger in diameter. This was to allow these pieces of drain pipe, i.e. gas-filled shells, to be pushed into the hole. They were actually called carduct shells. Once in the hole, a detonator was fitted and everyone retreated and the shell was fired. Now what happened then was there was a very sudden release of gas. Two barbs sprang out from the side of the shell, dug into the side of the shot hole to prevent the shell from being ejected by its own force of gas. The gas therefore had no option but to force its way up through the coal and rupture and break it. This tended to produce what we called round coal. Instead of an awful lot of dross, you got good clean round coal. So carduct shells were the order of the day in the mechanised section. And it was a highly productive system, but it did generate vast clouds of dust, and there was always a risk of coal dust explosions. Deputies and firemen had to be exceedingly careful to ensure that liberal amounts of stone dust were mixed through the coal dust lying on the floor. This to reduce the risk of coal dust explosions. That was the type of mining that I came back to. After some years in this, it was decided to sink a new colliery at Killick. And since I had been involved quite a lot in development work in my earlier years in the mine, but had never seen a shaft being sunk, I decided that this was something I would like to see. So I made inquiries about finding a job at Killick, which was just in its initial stages. At the time I first went there, a private company by the name of Bryden Construction Company were busy putting in concrete collars in both shafts. This was simply a ring of reinforced concrete being placed around a hole to reinforce the surface earth and prevent it falling in as the shaft was deepened. Bryden Construction Company actually did complete the first 60 feet of shaft sinking, lining the shaft with concrete. And at this point, Cementation Company took over for the eventual sinking, which was to go down to 2,500 feet, or half a mile in depth.
Did you become an engineer in the mines then?
Well, when I heard that a new colliery was starting at Killick, and since I'd always been interested in the development side of mining, I thought, now this is an opportunity to see shaft sinking. I had never been involved in shaft sinking. So I took a run down to Killick to see if there was any possibility of finding a job there, though I was in employment at that time. And I was asked about my experience, gave them the information they wanted, and I was asked if I could lay out the surface prior to the start of shaft sinking. That involved preparing for the sinking. I hadn't had experience in that line and told them so. So they decided to send me through to a colliery which was in process of being sunk at Bowness, called Kinneil Colliery. So I was sent through there for a period, and during that time I studied the surface layout, and I went down the shafts and saw the methods being employed in sinking the shaft and in concreting around the shaft wall, and I took notes on how things were being organised. And when I was satisfied that I had absorbed all the information I could, I returned to Killick. I was then given the job of laying out the surface roughly in the same fashion as I had seen at Kinneil Colliery, but I was also given a free hand to incorporate any kind of improvements that I thought I could make. So we did this, and when the surface was laid out, my job was then to ensure that good quality concrete was continuously available for lining the shaft walls. So I had to put together a squad of surface workers who were dependable, because when we started doing concrete work in the shaft walls, we worked continuously, 24 hours out of 24, and the walling cycle could go on for anything up to a week. So I had to have dependable men. So that's what took me to the shaft sinking side of things. After about a year there, there was a very nasty accident in the shaft when a section of the shaft caved in. It was a near disaster. We almost lost about 13 men who were working in the shaft bottom. And what resulted from that, and the photographs are there to be seen, was that a haulage engine attached to the winding caption was pulled right out of its foundation and dragged in against the surface. It finished up at the foot of what's known as the whorls. That's the winding mechanism. So it was a very nasty accident. Well, I became involved in the rescue work, getting these men out. Fortunately, we got them all out with minimal injuries and no loss of life. But it was, to use an expression, it was a bit hairy to get them out. Having got them out, our only option was to fill in the shaft back up past the point where the fall of rock had taken place, and then re-sink it. Again, I got involved in this, and when it was over and we had reclaimed the shaft and made everything secure, I was asked to take on the engineering job, which made me second in charge of the contract. The contract at that time was estimated at £25 million to complete the two shafts. So that's how I found myself to be on the engineering staff. Engineering, not in the sense of repairing machinery, though I had been a fitter in the Air Force for years. Engineering in the sense that we had to plan and execute underground programs, which involved ore pockets, skip landings, insets, and all the other things associated with deep shaft working. So I found it a very challenging, very interesting job. The unfortunate thing about it was that you had to sign a contract, which I still have, and you were to be available 24 hours a day, if required. So most days I would put in 10 hours, 11 hours, and very often was only just home when some emergency or other called you back. So you never really had any time to yourself, and that included weekends. So it was a very tiring and demanding job. But nevertheless, it was a challenging job, and I must say, I enjoyed it and I learned an awful lot. Both shafts were pushed down to a depth of half a mile, 2,500 feet. And the shaft diameters, respectively, after they had been concreted with 3 foot thick concrete walls, heavily reinforced with steel, the shaft diameter, in the case of number one shaft, was 24 feet, and in the case of number two was 20 feet. So there were very large holes in the ground, and they took enormous quantities of material in terms of concrete and steel to line these shafts from top to bottom. But unlike the old shafts, which were formed by timber mountings, these new concrete line shafts needed no maintenance. Once the shaft had been finished and the winding equipment installed, no maintenance was ever necessary in the life of the colliery from that point onwards. So in that sense, it was quite an achievement. Shankers, a term common in the old days, literally had a much easier job at Killick than they had in any of the old pits. That answers your question.
Mm-hmm. So you were, was there just, how many levels was there down?
In Killick, there were actually four levels. They tended to talk in levels about the yardage from the surface. So the first level was 570 yards down. That was the main level, and that worked. A main seam of coal. There was the L seam and a main coal seam, worked from a 570. The next level down was 630 yards. That worked the minor seam. And then below that again, we had the 770 yards. That was a level at which great difficulty was experienced because of the weight of roof and the bad roof conditions which prevailed. It was very difficult work in that level, difficult in the sense that even heavily reinforced concrete walls were crushed by the enormous pressures, and we had a lot of problems because of this crush, pavement heave, and deformation of roadways. Roadways which had been recently driven were deformed within a matter of 6 months in many cases, and this forced us to introduce a type of arch known as a TH arch, or a yielding arch. It was of German origin, and where the old rigid arches had no option but to buckle if the pressure exceeded their capacity to hold the roadway, the new arch actually telescoped slightly under pressure. And what you got then was a roadway which maintained its contour but slowly reduced in size, and it eliminated the need for a lot of back brushing and repair work. So though conditions were difficult, TH arches proved to be invaluable because they did eliminate an awful lot of repair work, which was normally referred to as back brushing, where roadways had become deformed, you'd had a lot of pavement heave, a lot of roof subsidence, and this had all to be redone on the old rigid arts, whereas with the modern yielding arts, the roadway became slightly and progressively smaller, but it still maintained its shape and was much easier to maintain. Now that's all I can tell you about the TH arches.
Mm-hmm.
They were available for roadways up to about 16 feet wide by 12 feet high. Anything over that unfortunately had to be dealt with by either straight girders or large section rigid arches.
Can you tell me about the big tunnel that you showed me in the photograph?
Yes. Killick was to be the first million tonne a year pit in Scotland. And it did eventually manage to produce its million tonnes. But this meant that there had to be provision made for winding very large quantities of coal. The old method of winding coal was to fill hutches and wind the hutches up in the cage, which each hutch then only carried about half a ton or 10 hundredweights. That was a sort of average weight. And cages were small and could only wind two hutches at a time. Obviously this was no use whatever in contemplating winding a million tons in a year. So provision had to be made to wind heavy quantities at any one time. For this purpose, it was decided to introduce what was known as skip winding. It required a new type of winding engine, and the winding engine was placed on top of a large preformed tower, roughly 120 to 150 feet high. The winding engine was enormous, and it worked on a principle known as the Kopy principle. It simply drove a large wheel, and over this wheel went the ropes from these ore skips. The ore skips were capable of lifting 20 tons of coal at a time. They were lowered from the surface by the high speed winder. When they got to the appropriate level, mainly the 570, they automatically were deflected by rollers into the ore pocket, the skip pocket. The loading system was automatic. As the skip engaged with the ore pocket, it operated a series of levers which discharged coal from a bunker with a capacity of 1,000 tons. The discharged coal was fed straight from the bunker into the skip to the extent of 20 tons. When 20 tons had been loaded into the skip, under the weight of the 20 tons, perceptibly sat down roughly a foot or so, and in doing so operated an off lever which prevented any further coal from being fed through into the skip. When this was done, the skip automatically engaged a lever which signalled the engine driver on the surface that it was loaded and ready for hoisting. The skip was then hoisted at high speed to the surface, where again it engaged with automatic machinery and discharged itself onto a conveyor belt which fed up into a screening plant where the coal was graded and cleaned. So that was the method of winding. The reason for the large size shaft was that two skips operated. As the one went up, the other went down, which meant literally was almost continuous winding, and in the course of a day they could lift an awful lot of coal. So that was the reason in the first instance for the size of the shafts being so large. In the number two shaft, there we had a cage which was a three-deck cage, and it carried 50 men on each deck. That was 150 men on each wine. Now when I compare this with the pit where I started as a boy, then the cage took four men only. So it took a long delay at the end of each shift to get up to the surface. You had to, what was known as cry your bend. When you came out to the pit bottom, invariably there was anything up to 100 men in front of you, and you called out who was last, and someone answered, and you then followed that man when he got what was known as his bend, which was his turn for going on to the cage. So you could be in the pit bottom for half an hour to three quarters after your shift. Whereas at Killick, 150 men could be wound literally at 45 feet per second, which was very fast winding. And as these men were discharged on the surface, as they went off on one side, 50 oncoming miners fed onto the, from the other side of the cage onto each deck. So the 150 who went up were replaced by 150 ready to go down. They were rapidly lowered, and the process was repeated until all the men were up and all the newcomers, the oncomers, were down. So that was the reason for large size shafts, because the cages and the skips were large in themselves.
Mm-hmm. Were the, both the shafts used for winding men?
The law requires that where you put more than nine men underground, you must have a secondary means of escape. So that in the event of one shaft going out for any mechanical reason or other reason, you had at least another alternative means of exit. Number two shaft was the one in which the cages operated, and there normal winding went ahead as long as things were okay in both shafts. But let's say that a fault developed in number two shaft. The ore skips were so fitted that false floors could be slid into the ore skips, and they could then be used as cages in the number one shaft to get the men out. So that was the system. You always had an alternative means of escape, as the law required.
Was coal wound up both the shafts, or just one shaft?
Mainly in the one shaft. And the reason for that was, if mine cars were filled with coal, they proceeded from the point of loading to what was known as the tippler, which was underground in one of the main tunnels. The tippler was a cylindrical apparatus, and the mine cars were fed through the tippler and were located accurately in the tippler. The tippler then revolved through 360 degrees, a full circle, which meant that the mine car in question was turned over so that it emptied its contents down a chute and into the ore pocket. The coal was then brought to the surface mainly by virtue of being loaded into the ore skip. However, on occasion when there was difficulty with the ore skip, on odd occasions, coal was loaded into mine cars, and these mine cars were loaded onto the cage and brought to the surface. More regularly, the loading of cars and which were brought to the surface, the cars were mainly loaded with rock from the mine driving, which was going on continuously underground. So that rock was loaded into cars, loaded onto the cage and taken up, in this case, two cars at a time. Only two decks were used, because had three loaded mine cars of rock been put on the cage, there would have been an overload question.
Mm-hmm.
So two were loaded on and the third deck was kept empty. So all that rock was taken out and tipped at a bing, what was known as a tip, and it's there to this day, this monstrous tip that resulted from all the excavations that we've done at Killer. So number two shaft was mainly used for sending down material and winding out rock from the developments underneath. Number one was exclusively used for coal and as an emergency man exit in the event of any upset.
Right. So can you remember what it was like going down in the cage? That was Killer.
I remember at Killer, yes. It was very high speed. Going back a bit further, the very first week I was in the bank number one, the old pit as we called it, I had a very frightening experience as a young boy of 14. Fortunately, I was with three older men in the cage, and the cage went what was known as off the slides. And these days, the old timber shafts, the cage travelled down a couple of wooden slides which went from top to bottom of the shaft. And these wooden slides acted like guide rails. And it, not infrequently, the cage used to jump off the guides. And that happened to me in the first week. It frightened the life out of me. But fortunately, the three other men who were on the cage with me were much older and much more experienced. I was only a laddie. The contrast with Killer was fantastic. We could go in there, 50 on each deck. The gates were closed. The cage was belled away, as we called it. And the progression was rapid from being a stationary cage. It was as if the floor had fallen out from beneath your feet. The drop away was very rapid. And until you get used to this, your stomach always come up into your mouth. In mid-shaft, the speed was high, 45 feet a second, but it could be taken out of the engineman's hands. There was a device known as a Lily controller fitted to the winding engine, and if the winding engine exceeded what was considered the safe winding speed of 45 feet a second, the Lily controller took over automatically as the speed exceeded this and applied the brakes progressively and brought the cage to a halt. The winding engine had then to start and lower the cage afresh. If you were happened to be in a cage which was being raised or lowered when the Lily controller took over, it could give you quite a fright, because if you were progressing down the shaft at 45 feet a second and the brakes were applied by the controller, the Lily controller, in effect, you buckled at the knees because the deceleration was so sudden that your body wanted to go on dropping, and your weight probably went up to something like 3 or 4 G, 3 or 4 times the normal weight. So it could bend your knees if the brake was suddenly applied by the Lily controller. It stopped you quite quickly. On the way up, if the Lily controller cut in through excessive winding speed, it was even more alarming, because the feeling was that the cage continued up for a few feet and then dropped back, and it felt as if the rope had broken. And it used to cause quite a bit of swearing among the men. They used to issue threats against the winding engine for exceeding the speed, so it could be quite alarming. But in the normal course, it was a very smooth wind, because there were no wooden guides as such. The cage ran on steel ropes which were kept taut by a device in the pit bottom, and it was a very smooth ride. In winter time, it could also be quite alarming, because surface water used to form massive icicles around the surface of the shaft, and periodically these icicles would break away and crash down the shaft and shatter on the roof of the cage. So if you were travelling up or down when a load of ice broke away from the what we call the fan drift, it could give you quite a fright. So that was the contrast from four men, a tow as they called it. A tow was one single wind. So we went from four men a tow to 150 men a tow, which was quite a contrast.
Can you tell me how mine driving's progressed over the years?
Well, mine driving goes back long before my time. But in the early days, it was a most laborious and difficult business. And these days, we're talking about the tail end of the last century. Mines were driven literally by sheer hard work. There were no automatic drills. Short hole drilling was done using what were known as jumper drills. These were in effect long shafted chisels which were hammered against the rock face to make holes for the placing of explosives. As you can imagine, hammering a chisel into stone, hard rock, was time consuming, very hard work, and very laborious. By the time I had reached school leaving age and gone to the mines, things had moved on quite a bit. I first saw drilling equipment in the form of a machine known as a rickety. This was the miner's name for it, but in effect, what it was a hand-operated drilling machine which used solely muscle power. It operated on a ratchet basis with a pull handle. A drill was attached to one end of it. That drill could be either suitable for drilling in coal or a harder face drill for drilling in rock. The back end of the machine was lodged tightly against a stout timber tree. And as the ratchet was pulled, it forced the drill into the coal or the stone, as the case may be. Again, it was difficult, it was very hard work, and it was time consuming. It was quite common to take up to an hour to bore one shot hole. Now obviously, this put a very severe limitation on the speed of mine driving. If a number of holes had to be bored, even if more than one rickety was used, it was still a lengthy process. Obviously, to suit modern mining conditions, something had to be done to speed up this process. When I first went stone mining, which was about 1936, as a youngster of 16 years of age, I was in time to see the introduction of compressed air drilling machines to help speed up the progress of mining in general, and mine driving in particular. A large compressed air machine was taken underground and assembled. Pipelines were led from it to any source where mines were being driven, and compressed air was available at a pressure of something between 80 and 100 pounds per square inch. Machines had been devised which not only rotated the drill rapidly, but also had a percussive element, which in effect was like a series of rapidly struck hammer blows. So the machines became known as rotary percussive drills, driven solely by compressed air. Initially, they were heavy and they were hard to hold, and one had to exert considerable pressure to force the drill into the rock. Not quite so bad in coal, where it was easier to get them to penetrate. But again, it was much, much faster, though still hard work. Gradually, the problem was worked upon, and various mining companies came up with a solution in the form of what was called an air leg. Quite simply, this was a leg which supported the weight of the machine. It had a telescopic center which could be extended by operating a small valve, and the extension of the leg which was attached to the drilling machine not only held the weight of the machine it also helped to force it with some considerable pressure into the rock that was being drilled. That proved to be a turning point. It then became possible to drill a hole in even in very hard rock in something around 3 to 4 minutes. The rock drill could be made to penetrate up to 7 feet, which was a normal cut or pull. 7 feet rounds, when I joined, were the sort of standard that was sought. In other words, you were faced with a solid rock face. The problem was to blast 6 or 7 feet of that out and make room for 2 supporting steel arches. The quicker this could be done, the quicker the mine progressed. And modern coal faces, especially in ground where geological faulting was rife, demanded fairly high speed rates of advance in stone mines. This to keep abreast of the continual need for opening up new seams and new face lines. The idea, therefore, was to introduce as many machines in a mine as it was practical to have. So where we had a mine of the fairly large size, around 17 feet wide, 12 feet high, as many as 6 drilling machines were in use at any one time. Obviously, a great deal depended on the pattern of shot holes, on the type of ground, whether it was excessively hard rock or medium hard rock, and of how the explosives were distributed through the shot holes on the face. I worked for a long period for a private company of contractors, cementation company, and we found that it was necessary to obtain high-speed drivage that we should train our mining crews and the various processes concerned in high-speed tunneling. The initial point of jump-off was to take a 6-man crew, which was normal for a 17-foot-wide roadway, and train each and every one of the men involved to handle a particular task. When drilling was on, the number one driller had a series of holes to drill. These were drilled in the centre of the face and were known as the cut shots. In effect, these were the shots which would be fired first, and they would open up a cavity in the centre of the face. This made it much easier for the successive shot holes to blast into the cavity formed by the first shots. Each man then was trained to drill the same series of holes every time the face was drilled. So we had 6 machines on, and each in turn would drill anything up to 20 to 30 shots, shot holes. It was so timed that 2 of the men had fewer holes to drill, something of the order of 10 to 12. And when they had drilled their particular short holes, they immediately dismantled the drilling machines and the hoses which fed the compressed air to the machines, carried them to a safe distance, and then working in conjunction with the short firer, they helped prepare the explosives and the primers ready for blasting. This while the final stages of boring were being completed. As soon as the boring had been completed, the remaining 4 machines were rapidly dismantled, carried back to a safe distance, and all 6 people then helped to charge the face under the supervision of a shift supervisor and, as required by law, the deputy or shot firer in charge. We found that with practice, up to 150 shots could be charged and something around half an hour. It was important that charging was properly done. Certain stipulations were required by the Coal Mines Act or the Mines and Quarries Act. The whole of the operation became the responsibility of the shot firer or the deputy in the workplace, and the charging could only be done under his supervision. In practice, to speed the process, each and every man of the six-man crew was authorised to place the explosives and the detonators under close supervision of the deputy, who was held statutorily responsible. This then speeded the charging operation. The next big problem was to find a method of putting off all of these shots simultaneously. Initially, when I started mining, we were only capable or able to fire six shot relays, six shots at a time. This meant that the charging and firing again was a slow, laborious program, and one had to run out and in through heavy smoke, find the shot holes, place the charges, place the detonators, retreat and fire another six. The small batteries that were used for this were known as six-shot exploders, were only capable of producing enough power to detonate six shots simultaneously. Obviously, this had to be superseded where high-speed mining was in vogue. It was superseded by a machine known as a Beethoven shot firer, capable of firing up to a theoretical 100 at any one time simultaneously. In fact, it could fire and did fire appreciably more than 100. 120 to 130 shots was quite common in a 17 foot wide mine, and almost daily we used patterns in hard rock which ran up to this number, and the Beethovens, provided the conditions were dry, handled this admirably. In each case, to make this central cavity in the face. Care had to be taken that in wet conditions there was no shorting out of the current. If, in fact, this angle was neglected, some of the current from the Beethoven could be short-circuited, and instead of 120 shots going off, what could happen was possibly 100 went off and 20 failed to go off, in which case you found you had a rock pile laced with unexploded explosives and primer detonators, a highly risky and dangerous business. It was therefore imperative that great care was taken to ensure that no leakages of current took place. Having said that, there was a very necessary pattern for the shots to be exploded in. It was necessary in the first instance to make a cavity in the centre of the face. The number one driller had drilled what was known as the cut shots. These took various forms, wedge cuts, burn cuts, various others, drag cuts, this kind of thing. The idea was the same in each case, to make this central cavity in the face. This then made it easier for successive shots to blow into the cavity thus created. Now, to do this without the need for running out and in, coupling half a dozen shots, doing another half dozen, detonators were devised with very fine limits of time between them. Certain ranges of detonators were used, and the commonest in mine driving were what were known as daily detonators. These daily detonators had a time element built into the detonator. The first one to go off had no delay whatever and was known as a zero, number nothing. A number one was the next to follow, and that had something like 40 milliseconds, 41 thousandth of a second of a delay built in. The number two had a similar delay, as had number three. From four onwards, the delay stepped up from 40 to 70 milliseconds. Now, with this delay element and the numbers of the detonators clearly shown, it was possible to put number one instantaneous deaths in the cut shots. Number two detonators were then put in the next innermost ring. Number three in the ring on the outside of that. Number four again on the ring outside that. So these shot holes were drilled in the form of an arch-shaped cycle of holes until the final set of outside or flank holes outlined the full dimensions of the tunnel. And by judicious and correct placing of the detonators, which were then all coupled together, the whole thing could be fired in one fell swoop. Regulations required that a long cable was used, and everyone prior to firing had to retreat a safe distance, which was something of the order of 200 yards. Find cover in a manhole, a refuge hole, while the detonations were taking place. Because of the very fine delay, the fine difference in the delays, it sounded almost like one continuous blast, though in fact it was a series of blasts, one rapidly following the other. Naturally, 120 shots or thereabout generated a great deal of smoke and dust. And if explosives had been overused, the problem became much worse, because the excess explosive literally created an excess amount of smoke. The other problem was that in firing so many shots, it was highly possible to knock out some of the protective steel arches which had already been erected to hold the roof and sides. Injudicious use or overuse of explosives often resulted in arches being knocked out, which obviously slowed progress, created a set of dangerous working conditions where roof supports had been blown away and required to be re-erected. So it rapidly became obvious that if high-speed drivage was to be obtained and maintained, it was very necessary that the people involved in mine driving should know exactly what each and every one should do and the fashion in which it should be done. To this end, each mine had a leading man. He had a bit of extra training and a supervisory capacity to ensure that all of these very important points were observed. Additionally, we had a supervisor who generally covered two or possibly three workplaces, and when he knew that short firing was about to take place in any one mine, he attended prior to the blast and did a final check to make sure that everything was in order. In spite of all these precautions, it was not unusual to have misfired shots for one reason or another. Possibly a wire on the detonator had been stripped of its insulation when it was being placed in the hole. This could lead to shorting out of the current on that particular detonator and the failure of the detonator and the explosives to explode. What then happened was somewhere in the muck pile, in the rock pile, which ensued after the explosion, we had this business of looking for live explosives. A situation which was not desirable and could lead to serious hazards. However, all due precaution was taken. Now initially, when we started doing high-speed mine driving, I am now talking of the era 1953 or thereabouts to 1975. During these 22 years, and we had approximately 8 mines going simultaneously in various parts of the pit. Many of these mines were large dimension and required great care, because in many instances they were undercutting other main roadways, so shot firing and roof support became paramount in achieving safe working practices. That had to be coupled with the need for this high speed drivage. And to give some idea, prior to setting up our own training school and training the mine drivers concerned, we were achieving distances weekly of something around 10 yards of an advance. Once we had our training school going for some considerable time and had thoroughly trained all the personnel associated, we regularly achieved 40 yards in a week. And we did, on one occasion, set up a new mining record where in 5 days, with 3 5-man crews working on shift, we cut 67 yards or 201 feet in 5 working days. That was our best ever at Killer. It showed what could be done if appropriate training was given to the people involved. There was a great willingness on the part of the men involved to learn these techniques. They actually prided themselves on being known as tunnel tigers. They set themselves high targets. We, on the supervisory side, were required to set a weekly target and to initiate a bonus scheme for work which was properly and safely completed. And invariably, the crews involved were so keen to achieve record cutting that it resulted in very good bonuses for them. Looking back to the old time mine driving, in which I was initially involved at the age of 16, and comparing it to the mine driving which was carried out at Killick in the 50s to 70s, the contrast was very striking. Where in the old days, with the old methods, it was considered to be quite good progress for 3 consecutive shifts, working shift work, to achieve 6 foot of an advance in 24 hours. On the record week of which I've just spoken, we actually on 3 separate occasions managed not one set of girders, not 1 6-foot advance, we actually had 18 feet of an advance in each 7.5-hour working shift, erecting no less than 6 arches. This gives some idea of the contrast.
So how did you manage to dispose of the rock that you had blasted down as quickly as possible?
Well, here again, there were vast changes in the period that I've spoken about, from 1936 to the mid-1970s. There was literally a revolution. Initially, when rock was blasted way back in the 30s, The only way to dispose of this was by hand shovels. This was really back-breaking, hard, hard toil. After a round of shot, she was faced with possibly something of the order of 50 tons of rock to be disposed of. And the crew in these days was probably around 4 or 5 men at most. So it constituted a very hard shift in trying to dispose of as much of this rock as possible. Often it took 2 or more shifts to clear a round of rock. Again, it was very obvious that something had to be devised to speed up this process. The answer came in the form of various machines. In early days, a machine called a slusher was in regular use. It was proved to be cheap, quite efficient, but a bit messy. The method of a slusher and the method of using it was, it had 2 drums, each with a rope. One rope was called the tail rope, the other was called the head rope. It had a bucket, not unlike a small dragline bucket as used in open cast sites. The bucket had 2 points of attachment for these ropes. The tail rope was attached to the back side of the bucket, the head rope attached to the snout of the bucket. A loop of the tail rope was placed over a heavy steel pulley which was firmly anchored to a shot hole in the rock face, so that we had a pull and return rope. So what initially happened, the tail rope was tightened by pulling a lever on the slusher and it dragged the bucket in towards the face line where the pulley was located. The bucket was then dropped by slackening the rope onto the muck pile. The head rope lever was then pulled, and the head rope was rewound to the drum, dragging with it the bucket and a bucket load of the hard rock. The bucket was fitted with heavy spiked steel teeth, which dug into the rock and dragged it forward to the tail end of a conveyor which was mounted adjacent to the slusher, so that literally the bucket went out and in, and each time it brought with it a load of broken rock which it dumped onto the conveyor end. That was fairly cheap, fairly quick in clearing grounds, but it was never a tidy method. So the problem was studied, and again it was decided it could be improved on. So some of the mining companies were contacted, and probably the best known was the manufacturers of a machine called an EIMCO, E-I-M-C-O, an EIMCO loader. These were produced in various forms. The most popular form was a tracked machine, almost like a small edition of a bulldozer. However, instead of a blade, it had a bucket, similar in type to what are used on surface JCBs. This bucket was used to load out the rock spoil. The machine was driven mainly by compressed air, though it could be in certain circumstances electrically driven. Electrical versions weren't favoured in the coal mines because of the risk of sparking or arcing igniting gases and causing explosions. So generally speaking, it was compressed air versions which were used in the mines. The fact that these were tracked vehicles made them extremely manoeuvrable. By running one track in reverse and one forward, they could turn in their own lengths. When a rock pile was lying on the ground and the roof had been secured from the top of the rock pile and the top shot holes bored in the next face, The machine then started to load out. It was driven by 100 pounds air pressure through a 3-inch diameter flexible bag. It ran forward rapidly in its tracks with the bucket lowered and charged into the muck pile. This loaded the bucket. The bucket was then hoisted full of broken rock and the machine retreated to the end of the conveyor where it threw the bucket over its head. The bucket was able to go right over to the back of the machine and discharge its load. The operator stood on a step at one side of the machine, so he was out of the way of the bucket. This was found to be very rapid compared to the old slushing method. It was also found that in big wide roadways, for which Killick was famous, it could deal with reasonable quantities in reasonable times, but again the need for urgency, for speed and mind driving, necessitated that something even larger should be brought about and thought about. The ultimate outcome of this was that Einkel produced a machine known as an Einkel 40. This was quite a machine, costly but extremely efficient and very, very fast. It ran on rails which were laid centrally in the workplace. These rails were kept uptight to the face area. When a round was fired, there was a rock pile of the order of 70 tons or thereabouts. This machine could actually dispose of such a rock pile in something around 1 to 1.5 hours. The bucket was huge. It had a capacity of something like 2/3 of a cubic yard. It could sweep from side to side so that from one side to the other it could cover an arc of the full width of the roadway, 17 feet or thereabouts. On the back end of the machine, part of the machine, was a conveyor, a rubber conveyor belt, which could be elevated or it could be swung from one side to the other in the form of an arc. This allowed the loaded bucket to throw its rock, its material, onto this conveyor, which was kept running, and that carried the rock. It was only a matter of about 10 or 12 feet long, and it carried the rock rapidly along its length and dumped it into an empty mine car. So this machine, while expensive to purchase, was a real boon in high-speed mining. It made it possible, if we take it in stages, to start with what was known as a straight up and down face. That was a mine which was fully geared right up tight to the rock face. The drilling cycle could be completed easily within half an hour. The charging cycle took roughly the same time. The setting of the roof crowns, that's the top part of the arches, took place immediately after firing of the face, using the muck pile as a means to get up high enough to set the crowns and make the roof secure. The mucking cycle then started, and the mucking cycle could be handled, as I've already said, in something like an hour to an hour and a half. The girder legs were then attached, strutted and timbered. Again, something like half an hour. So initially, we found that around a 7-foot advance could take place in something approaching 4 hours. As time went on and the men became more and more adept and more practiced in their particular part of the cycle, we found that even in these big roadways, it was quite possible to do 2 complete rounds. That is, each girder was set 3 feet ahead of its neighbour. Each round was drilled for 7 feet. Invariably, a little bit of a socket was left at the back of the hole, but always 6 feet or 6 feet six was pulled with the shots. That allowed for the erection of two arcs, and the whole cycle could be repeated again inside a 7.5 hour shift. That was the method. There are other methods employed in later years, especially on projects like the Channel Tunnel, where giant tunnelling machines, moles as they were called, made it possible to, by rotating discs, to cut their way through in a circular tunnel and load out their own material on specially built conveyors which were integrated with the machine. That, I think, disposes of the method of muck disposal. Of fire, we can have machines which overheat, bearings which overheat, generate smoke or even flames. And in mines, this can be very serious because the ventilation in a mine is such that the air coming down the shaft is fed through the various workings. And if at any point in any one of these workings fire breaks out in any degree, it can cause a serious risk to life because the fumes and smoke are carried in on the ventilation currents and spread to almost every corner of the mine. To defeat this, precautions are taken by lining most of the modern mines with fireproof material. This can be in the form of boards about 6 inches wide, treated with special fire retardant chemicals. These boards are placed skin for skin around the steel arches so that the tunnel is lined literally with a fireproof material, generally called tunnelized timber. In some areas, however, where the risk is considered greater, such as locomotive charging stations where high voltage currents are in daily use, instead of tunnelized timber, concrete slabs are used in the flanges of the girders so that literally what is produced is a concrete lined tunnel. Then, should a battery explode or a locomotive go on fire or anything like this, the risk of it setting alight to a timber behind the girders is minimized. This risk of smoke traveling through mine airways is so serious that it necessitated the production of what was known as a self-rescue kit. There was, many years ago, a very large-scale disaster in England at Gresford Colliery, where a conveyor belt, a rubberized conveyor belt, caught fire due to friction, and the smoke emanating from this belt travelled through extensively through the airways of the mine and accounted for close to 100 deaths. Following on this, measures were taken and the whole thing was looked at with a view to enabling men to travel at least for a limited period through a smoke-filled atmosphere without inhaling the poisonous smoke. This became known as a self-rescue outfit. It was carried on your belt along with your mining lamp, and it was in a steel container protected against dust or moisture or any other thing which might damage the respirator inside. It was a small respirator with an attached, a roughly cylindrical filter. It was filled with chemically treated charcoal, etc. And in the event of coming across unexpectedly a smoke hazard where breathing was difficult, you were instructed how to operate this self-rescue apparatus, remove the respirator from its case, put it in your mouth and put a nose clip on to prevent breathing through your nose. You then breathed solely through the respirator mouthpiece, and the smoke was filtered to such an extent that you were able to walk through the smoke-filled area, provided you could do so in half an hour. The duration of the apparatus, which simply filtered out the harmful fumes, was half an hour. Anything over that, then you were in difficulty. And if you had occasion to use the respirator for 20 minutes or 25 minutes, the cylinder which contained the filtering material became quite warm because of the chemical reaction of the chemicals inside. So you found that you were literally breathing hot air. And the longer you kept it in your mouth, the hotter the air became that you were breathing through it. But it did prove to be a means of saving life. So that was another hazard and another method of countering it.
So can you tell me what the major differences were in comparing the old type of mind driving to the modern type of mind driving?
Yes, in a word, size. When I started in the mines in the 1930s, a fairly large mine was considered to be a 10-foot by 8-foot roadway. This was generally regarded as a main roadway and was adequate for the type of mining that was then going on in the development of coal faces, etc. However, the modern mines, with the introduction of power loading and ranging shearers which produced vast quantities of coal, they required very large installations in the way of broad conveyor belts, and these conveyor belts had to deal with large outputs from various faces. At Killoch, coal was wound up the shafts, as we've already said, in ore skips, which carried 18 to 20 tons at the time, to ensure a buffer between the skip winding and the coal being produced underground, to ensure there was no waiting period and there was a buffer between the output and the winding. It was necessary to drive very, very large roadways so that a large bunker type installation could be made to hold the surplus coal until it could be got away in the skips. The last roadway we did in Killoch, of which we have provided some photographs, was 25 feet wide by 18 feet high. This as opposed to a main roadway of 10 by 8 in the old workings. This roadway was actually capable of taking two Decker buses side by side. But in it, once it was completed, was installed a bunker capable of accepting 1,000 tons of coal. The base of the bunker was actually a steel conveyor with flight bars. And what happened was the conveyor belt went continuously, bringing up vast quantities of coal, which was discharged into this bunker. The bunker, in turn, was coupled through the shaft wall to what was called the skip pocket in the shaft. As a skip came down the shaft, it automatically located itself in the loading bay of the skip pocket, and in so doing, activated levers which set in motion the conveyor which was inside the large bunker and fed coal through until it loaded the skip. The skip, when it had reached its full capacity, was capable of stretching the rope, the steel rope to which it was attached. And as the load was applied, the rope stretched about a foot. In doing this, it activated a further lever when the skip was full and cut off the delivery from the bunker, so that continuously you had coal feeding in at one end from the conveyor belt, and almost continuously at the other end you had two skips alternating, one up, one down, picking up 18 ton loads and conveying them to the surface.
This marks the end of the interview on mining methods. The interview was conducted by Miss Jane Simpson for the Naskin Industrial Museum. Addendum. Throughout this narrative, I have made no mention whatsoever of the true cost of mining. It is and was a well-known fact, especially in the days of private ownership, that the winning of coal took a very heavy toll in the form of lives lost, with some major accidents occurring in and around the local coal fields. Of these, I can well remember a major disaster in 1937 in what was known as the New Mine or Number 6 Mine at Bank, part of the new Cumnock Colliery Group. And in this accident, men were wound up a gradient of about 30 degrees or 1 3/4. The winding up was done in a rake of 8 hutches, and inside each hut sat 4 men with their bottoms on the bottom of their hutch and their knees pulled up to their chin. The mine in which they were wound was very restricted, having a brick wall close to the hut sides on each side of the small mine up which they were wound. The length of the mine was approximately 1 mile. On one occasion in 1937, when 28 men were being wound to the surface, the winding rope broke when the rake was only about 100 yards from the mine entrance and on its way to the surface. The 8 hutches in question flew down the mine, gathering speed all the way, and about 3/4 of the way down the mine, they managed to come off the track and impact a large butt of coal. The chaos was indescribable. 5 men were killed outright. The remaining 23 suffered some very severe injuries, some critical, and some inordinately lucky to have survived at all. That was one very serious disaster in the New Cumnock Colliery Group. Throughout the years, there were numerous small disasters where one or two lives were lost by explosion of mine gases, etc. The largest by far of any mining accidents in this area took place in September 1950, when after 3 days of torrential rain, a mine which was being driven upwards towards the surface from the underground workings of Castle Colliery actually penetrated into the bowl of peat which lay above the area where the mine was to surface. Because of the fact that a peat symbol shown on ordnance survey maps was ignored, plus the fact that 3 days of torrential rain had turned the peat semi-liquid, provoked what could have been a shattering loss to the village of Newcomnock. The mine actually penetrated the base of this huge bowl of peat, and the resultant inrush of the peat into the workings could be measured in hundreds of thousands of tons, the crater being created roughly the size of 3 football pitches and about 100 feet deep in the centre. The inrush was so great into the workings underneath that it picked up a locomotive and a full train of loaded hutches and carried it before the inrush as if they were toys. This actually proved to be a saving factor, because the men who were trapped in by on the inside workings of the pit were prevented from being engulfed by the fact that this locomotive and the hutches in question piled up and formed a rough barrier which prevented the peat from progressing right to the far end of the mine. 129 men were trapped from the Thursday back shift and only released after 2 days of hell, when to all intents and purposes the odds were against any possible rescue. The miracle of a phone cable which survived the inrush and provided a link between the trap pen and the surface permitted discussion on what should or should not be done. The mould mine number 6, which had previously featured in the runaway just described in 1937, now paid its bill. It was the only possible way of access to the trapped men, but regrettably was full of very explosive methane gas. In spite of all efforts with the best possible equipment, the gas could only be removed up to a point about half a mile from where the men were trapped behind a barrier 24 feet thick of coal, which had stood for some years between bank number 6 and bank number 1. A rescue was eventually effected using a Salvis apparatus, a small oxygen-filled cylinder with a mouthpiece and nose clip, used by the fire brigade in circumstances where fumes were present. And only the fact that sufficient of these were gathered up from America and elsewhere permitted the rescue brigade to effect a rescue of the trapped men through a tunnel driven through the 24 feet butt of coal. It was little short of a miracle that anyone was without. However, unhappily, 13 men did not escape. 2 of these suffered what must be regarded as the most horrible death in the circumstances, and one which every miner dreaded. They were trapped uninjured in a blind end, plugged at the open end by the inrush of peat. They were therefore in a sealed section of workings from which no possible escape could be made, and this they must have realised very early on. When the bodies were eventually recovered, it was noted that they had attempted to keep track of time and had lived, as it was thought, for a week or just over.
realizing that this was done without food or water, and that their lights, even on emergency bulb, would only last for some 24 hours. They must have died a terrible death, knowing that that was the only possible outcome of their predicament. Other men were actually caught in the inrush and carried in to various sections of the main tunnel in the West Mine. It took a year before the underground workings could be cleared of the peat and the last of the bodies recovered, by which time decomposition had set in and the job of trying to identify the bodies was an almost impossible task, and certainly a most unpleasant one. These then were the two major disasters in the New Cumnock collieries, one prior to nationalisation and private ownership, the other after nationalisation. While these were the major disasters in the area, there was an explosion at Kames Colliery, Muirkirk, which accounted for quite a loss of life, and at Killoch, that too took its toll, not in large mining accidents, but a continual, steady loss of life, one every now and again. One of the most horrific being when a worker by the name of William Dykes from Coal Hall fell 800 feet down the shaft from the surface, and the job of recovering what was left of his body was one not likely to be forgotten. There were other incidents of similar nature, and one of the most distressing, which I experienced just before leaving the mining industry, was when a man accidentally stepped into a conveyor which had been put in reverse by mistake, and both legs were amputated just above the ankle. We had the job of stemming the blood flow, getting him quickly to the surface, and then going back to recover his feet. An experience not likely to be forgotten. These then were the true costs of mining. I have not mentioned the financial side of it, but Killoch was by far and away the largest mining contract ever tackled in this county. Two shafts were sunk, each to a depth of 2,500 feet. These shafts were respectively 30 feet in excavated diameter and 24 feet in excavated diameter. They had to be lined with 3-foot thick concrete walls heavily reinforced by steel. So in effect, the two shafts, if laid on the side, represented very large tunnels over a mile in length. The cost of this was estimated in many, many millions of pounds. Following on the completion of shaft sinking, some 35 miles of tunnelling was carried out underground, much of this on a very large scale. The cost can only be guessed at, and to my knowledge, no figures were ever published to give the overall cost of developing Killoch. It must, however, go in the Guinness Book of Records as being one of the most expensive and shortest-lived collieries on record. Sinking was started at New Year in 1953, picking over from Bryden Construction Company when the shafts were at 60 feet. cementation took on the task of the rest of the sinking. It lasted approximately 6 years due to heavy pressurized water being encountered at various depths from 800 feet downwards. Mine driving then took place over the next 16 years. This being necessary because due to very severe geological faulting where coal seams were being continually lost, new mines had to be driven at top speed so that replacement face lines and coal seams were available for redevelopment. The cost of this would have amounted to a king's ransom. Killich was to have been the first million ton a year colliery in Scotland, and it was for a short period. But the outlay in terms of money spent on development must have many times outweighed the money derived from the sale of the coal mine at Killich. It was, in essence, a white elephant on the grandest scale imaginable. So, in terms of loss of life and in terms of loss of money, mining in Ayrshire, in the old days, using the old methods, proved mainly profitable to the private owners. From the time that nationalisation took place, many unnecessary jobs were, in the opinion of the workers, created for certain elements of the workforce, and the overall costs of production spiralled because of the many posts thus created. A deal of resentment was felt by the men who still had to work on the coal faces, do the actual production and cope with the conditions therein. In fact, to quote an oft-favoured phrase, there were far too many chiefs and not enough Indians. That then is the miner's side of the mining industry. Throughout my 40-odd years in the mines, I must have pay regard and respect to miners as a breed. Wherever or whenever there was an accident, there was never any shortage of volunteers. Though lives had to be laid on the line to effect rescues, this was never a consideration which daunted any of the miners. There were always more volunteers than there was work for. And this because of the realisation by all in the mining industry that there, but for the grace of God, go I. It might have been me. In consequence, there were always plenty of helpers available, whatever the circumstances. My experience of mining on a personal basis left me with the impression that far from the common belief that miners were, as a breed, rather dull on the uptake, nothing could have been more wrong. From personal experience, some of the finest, yes, and the most intelligent men I have ever known were in the mines. This simply because the area offered no other alternative other than agriculture. So the choice had to be made, mining or agriculture. There was little in the way of prospects if one chose to be a shopkeeper or a shop assistant. At least, in the mines, there was a camaraderie This followed from the tough times of the 1920s, when strikes were the miners' only weapons and were only resorted to in desperation to try and obtain a living wage. Money at that time was all important to the private owners, and they literally screwed the miners down to a point where it was barely able to eke out an existence, even though working a 44-hour week and grabbing at any opportunity of a little bit of overtime. The net result was there was a community spirit where all had shared the hardships and recognised when their fellows were in difficulty, and a helping hand in these circumstances was always forthcoming. I therefore have concluded my life in the mines with the impression that I worked with a fine lot of men. Of course, there was the odd rogue, but the majority of miners were hard-working and honest, and I consider it a privilege to have known many of them. With that remark, I close my comments on mining, this now being in the year 2001.